everyone. We are jumping back into Discrimination and Disparities by Thomas Sowell today. If you liked last episode, you'll like this one just as much. So make sure to go grab the book on Amazon. At the least, get it as a gift for someone because it's an easy read and a devastating read. So we'll go through chapter two today. It's titled Discrimination, Meanings, and Costs. I'm not going to be quoting large paragraphs the whole episode, but I do want to start off giving you an idea what Sowell's getting at here. Some people are said to have discriminating tastes when they're especially discerning and detecting differences in quality and choosing accordingly, whether choosing wines, paintings, or other goods and services. And he notes this. Something similar can be observed when it comes to people. It is common in countries around the world for some people to have different outcomes when they're judged by others in employment, educational, and other contexts. And here's the ultimate question related to the chapter. What kind of discrimination has led to such disparate outcomes? Or in other words, are group disparities and outcomes a result of internal differences in behavior and capabilities? Or are those disparities due to external impositions based on the bias, misjudgments, and antagonism of outsiders? So he breaks down discrimination into two types, namely discrimination type one and discrimination type two. Discrimination type one is what he describes as, quote, an ability to discern differences in the qualities of people and things and choosing accordingly. Discrimination type two would be arbitrary assumptions or aversions concerning individuals of particular race or sex. And his next point really made me think. Discrimination type one insinuates that we would view others as individuals and judge them by their characters. But he also points out that context is very important. He gives an example. A professor entering a classroom on the first day of the academic year may judge and treat each student as an individual, but that same professor walking down a lonely street at night may not judge and react to each stranger on the road ahead as an individual. And he makes a very good point. Look, as libertarians, we do think it's important to judge others by their characters because in reality, it's leftists that don't. Collectivism drops you in a pot where your individuality is forgotten and specifically, you're not viewed as an individual. Maybe you will momentarily if they want to use you as a political pawn, but you don't matter to them. It's still the point stands, if you're walking down a dark alley and you see a shadowy dark figure up ahead, you could choose to judge that person as an individual and walk past. You might be fine. The difference is, if it happened to be a mistake to do so, it could cost you your life. Context matters. Going on, he breaks the idea of discrimination type 1 into discrimination 1A and 1B. 1A is what would be the ideal version, meaning we base decisions solely off evidence about the individual. 1B would be less than idea, but would involve basing individual decisions on group evidence. Think about this example. Say we're comparing two groups of people and in each there is a percentage of alcoholics. In group X, for example, let's say there's 40% of the individuals are alcoholics. And let's say in group Y, that 1% of the individuals are alcoholics. If it were an employer making a decision, they're much more likely to hire people from group Y, considering you have a 99% chance that you won't hire an alcoholic. But also think about this. Group X consisted of individuals in which 60% were not alcoholics, yet they would be very likely to be excluded from employment nonetheless in this example. So what matters, especially to an employer, is cost. If alcoholics produce more defective products, this is an additional cost that should have been avoided in the first place. A real-life example was a study that showed that despite the reluctance of many employers to hire young black males because a significant amount have criminal records, those particular employers who did automatically do background checks on all their employees tended to hire more black males than all of the employers. Why would that be so? Well, since the nature of the work made criminal background checks worth the cost for all employees, it was no longer necessary to use group information to assess whether individuals, namely black males, can get a job. He even talks about how the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission often advocates prohibiting the employers from asking about criminal records. Empirically, though, however, criminal background checks, as he notes, provided more employment opportunities for young black males. Religion. Of course, religion can be problematic. In the 19th century, American Irish Protestants and Irish Catholics often couldn't work together. Violence would arise. So his point there is, discrimination would specifically provide a more efficient workplace. And it's pretty obvious that going to work and not wanting to fight others would allow for more efficiency. Sex plays a huge role in that quote. When a particular occupation is overwhelmingly chosen by women, such as nursing, the employer may be reluctant to hire a male nurse, regardless of that male nurse's individual qualifications. You can imagine how this extends to all sorts of fields. High crime neighborhoods are discriminated more against. And he points out that, well, even in high crime neighborhoods, though most people aren't criminals, the cost of sorting the local population individually can be high. When he says sorting, he means to evaluate. It'd be impossible to evaluate every single person in a high crime area before you go through it. You most likely just wouldn't go there. Not worth it. And he notes, quote, some businesses will not deliver their products, whether pizza or furniture, to these dangerous areas. Even taxi drivers may refuse transport to these areas. There's a study titled The Poor Pay More, and it argued that the poor pay more for consumer goods. And this was, quote, echoed in the media, in government, and in academic publications. But like we mentioned previously, these areas are generally more dangerous. The cost of higher prices wasn't based on discrimination type 2, but based on type 1. Customers are less likely to shop in areas where they may be robbed, harassed, etc. That's why prices are higher. And just to devastate the study's argument further, he points out that low-income neighborhood stores' rates of profit on investments were not higher than average, but lower than average. The prices weren't high because they're ripping off the consumer. If they didn't charge those prices, they wouldn't be able to order their next round of inventory. And of course, leftists did not denounce profit, but what is profit other than making a sacrifice and hoping to get something more out of it? Individuals don't seek to operate at a loss, and especially businesses don't. Once your revenue minus your cost is zero or less than zero, you have no money to keep the business going. Marxists argue that, you know, profit's the unpaid wages related to labor because the product sells for more than the labor that went into it. But no, duh. If it were any other way, there'd be no jobs and no products. Again, cost is the root of all of this. This doesn't just affect low-income minorities either. The Cincinnati Inquirer reported that residents of Eastern Kentucky refer to the higher prices and interest rates common in their area as the hillbilly tax. How about that? Now, discrimination too, it surely has existed to greater extents decades and centuries ago, though some will act like no progress has been made, but it's still worth exploring these instances of what we'd call arbitrary discrimination. So we'll be talking about causes. How about age? Well, Japanese Americans have a median age more than two decades older than the median age of Mexican Americans. He points out that even if both these groups had the same level of income, there would still be a massive disparity. If one group lives twice as long as the other group, you think they can accomplish twice as much, or at least they had the opportunity to? Seems reasonable. But aside from race, experience based on the number of years involved plays a huge role. Experience. College. Three quarters of all college degrees in education go to women, and more than three quarters of all college degrees in engineering go to men. That's honestly pretty well known, actually. So discrimination or personal choices, you decide in this next one. He goes on into costs and their effects, and I love this quote. Society is seldom a decision-making unit, except perhaps at election time or during a mass uprising. So to understand decisions in general, you have to understand incentives and constraints. In the book, The Declining Significance of Race by William Julius Wilson, showed that white Southern landowners and employers post-Civil War sought to keep down the earnings of Black workers. Now, on the contrary, Bob Higgs, who I hope you all know, found that such organized efforts often collapse as a result of competition among white employers and landowners for Black workers and sharecroppers. Black incomes per capita, though in 1900, were 50% higher than they had been in 1867 to 1868. Bob Higgs again notes that Black incomes grew more rapidly than white incomes over the last third of the 19th century, and about 90% of Blacks lived in the South during that era. South Africa under apartheid, the government was ruled by white supremacists, as you may know. In competitive industries, Blacks were often hired more than they were allowed to under apartheid laws. In fact, in the 1970s, a crackdown led to firms who hired in excess of Black workers. They were fined. He still notes that in some industries, Blacks even outnumbered whites in some particular job categories where it was illegal for Blacks to be hired at all. Even though races were often separated, many non-whites lived in white-only areas. And economist Walter Williams, he did research there many years ago and stayed in one of these white-only areas. The book Williams came out with is called South Africa's War Against Capitalism. I actually have not read that book, but I imagine it's great. It's on my list. So the reason these laws were broken is because, quote, while racists tend to prefer their own races, individuals tend to prefer themselves most of all, meaning if an employer can hire blacks and make more profit than hiring whites, why wouldn't he do it? If he's more greedy, he'll do that. Well, only if they have so much pride as to value that more than profit, again. So segregation in the U.S., how did that fare? Well, before segregation laws were passed, 3 decades after slavery ended, it was, quote, common for blacks and whites to sit wherever they felt like sitting on public transportation in the South. And here's a key point. Many, if not most of the bus and trolley companies during that era were privately owned. Their profits depended on the amount of customers they had. So if one private company decides to segregate, well, you might be losing half your profits, especially if your competition openly embraces inclusivity. Long story short, the government came in, cracked down, and began charging municipal transit company employees for violating these segregation laws. This was government. Private business was working just fine before that. Just fine. The telephone industry, and this is an interesting story. The American Telephone and Telegraph Company, also known as AT&T, had 331 black women working for them in 1930 out of more than 230,000 women in the occupation itself. Let me repeat that one more time. Out of 230,000 women in the telephone industry, only 331 were black in 1930. As late as 1950, black women still only amounted to 1% of all the women telephone industry workers. Now, after fair employment practices came about during the 50s and 60s in northern states, many telephone companies reversed their policies and blacks began to be hired disproportionately. Black telephone operators increased more than threefold between 1950 and 1960, but it wasn't until 1964 that the first black telephone operator was hired in places like New Orleans, South Carolina, or Florida. And again, here's another important part, because remember, these fair employment practices existed mostly outside the South until the 60s. And the 11 states that formed the Confederacy, it was found that the share of blacks among male employees of these companies declined. This will make more sense in a second. In oil and gas, it was the same thing, because again, the North had these quote unquote fair employment practices, and increases of blacks were confined to states outside the South. The point is, these companies paid no cost for discriminating against blacks before the laws, nor were there costs for hiring blacks afterwards. The phone companies had a monopoly. Anyway, does that make more sense now? Now, before World War II, there were 300 black research chemists employed in private businesses, but only 3 black PhDs employed by white universities. Again, private businesses are private and are less likely to discriminate because they care about profit, while government can run institutions and pay no price either way. That's the point. They can just make up the difference somehow. Minimum wage. This is a topic I could go on an hour myself, but there's so much to say. The minimum wage resulted in 2 consequences. One is that there is an increased number of job applicants. They see a higher wage and they want to work. 2 is that there will be less people that will be hired. Labor is a fixed cost in business, and when fixed costs rise, they either get dispersed or you take the hit. Employers seek to not go under and let costs get out of hand. The Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 resulted in a national minimum wage, but it's important to remember that the following decade after that experienced high rates of inflation. So in effect, there was no minimum wage law. And George Stigler pointed out in 1946 that, quote, the minimum wage provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 have been repealed by inflation. In just 1948, for example, though, the unemployment rate for black teens was 9.4%, while for white counterparts, it was 10.2%. That's right. In 1948, the unemployment rate of black teens was less than that of whites. Again, during the 40s, it was a decade of inflation, but following in the 50s and the 60s were the clear results of the minimum wage laws. For most years since 1967 moving forward, the black teen unemployment rate has been over twice that of white teens. Over twice. Labor force participation was about the same too, and blacks, again, had a higher participation rate before. When these laws kicked in, same thing happened. So right down to the last section of the chapter, it's related to building restrictions. So during the 70s, there was this whole preserve open space, save farmland, protect the environment, et cetera, type movements. And coastal California, that is from San Francisco to San Jose, was one of the largest regions where these restrictions existed. For example, California home prices were similar to those of the rest of the country, but after these laws came into effect. Home prices rose to more than three times the national average. In Palo Alto, adjacent to Stanford University, home prices nearly quadrupled during the 1970s, and they didn't become more expensive. There were no more homes built. During the 1970s, there were no more homes built there. So even by the early 2000s, the top 10 areas in the U.S. with the biggest home price increases occurred in California. In Harlem, which was predominantly white as late as 1910, there were efforts to limit blacks from moving there. What were the effects? Well, quote, those white landlords and realtors in Harlem who held out while others began to rent to blacks found themselves losing white tenants who moved out of the neighborhood as blacks moved in, leaving the holdout buildings with many vacancies representing lost rent. He ends by noting that in terms of end results, the actions of those in Harlem failed to keep blacks out, and the actions of California drove away tenants. Costs matter. That's it for today, folks. Again, pick up your copy of the book. Tomorrow we'll discuss chapter 3, which talks about sorting and unsorting people. See you there.